Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for February 23rd, 2009, and on this week's episode, Tom Williams interviews producer Tony DeAngelo. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I have a very special guest this week. He is one of the legendary producers in Chicago. His name is Tony DeAngelo, and he is one of the producers of The Quiet Man Tales. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Tom.
Great. Tell us about The Quiet Man Tales. Most people, and I'm going to throw an anecdote, we're here at the Chicago Theater, where down in the basement, in the very intimate theater, is where the Quiet Man Tales are going to be. I saw the movie with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara before there was a live show before it.
Oh, wow.
In the 1950s. I will tell you, I was 10, 11 years old. And I remember John Wayne, and it was one of the funniest movies ever. It's still considered one of the great films ever made.
Totally great movie, and we're so thrilled to be doing it. It's really, it was based on a novel called Green Rushes, which was, the title was later changed to The Quiet Man and Other Stories.
And
it was really
scene.
Five little short stories written by Maurice Walsh.
Okay.
And one of those little stories is The Quiet Man part. Which they made the movie out. The play we're doing is called The Quiet Man Tales, and it's based on that original novel, and it's three stories. They're intertwined. It takes place during the Irish Revolution and
from that, like 1919 to 21, right?
When 19 to 21, and that period. And it's very interesting, and so we're very excited about the whole project.
Just to make sure people know, that John Ford changed the original, Maurice's original story, to fit John Wayne as the older.
That's right.
And it was also one of the things that discovered, that Maureen O'Hara got discovered.
That's right. Yeah. And you know that we sent the script to her, just
great.
For her opinion.
I didn't know, she's still alive, huh?
She's absolutely alive.
Thank God, I wasn't sure of that.
If you notice any of our advertising, there's a quote from her.
Yes, I did see that on the press notes.
That was a beautiful letter she wrote, saying that she just loved the script. We're hoping that she's going to be able to come out.
Wow. If she does, I'll have to get her on this podcast.
She's got a magazine called Maureen O'Hara Magazine. Look at it. And
okay.
She's got all our theatrical stuff there. She's got our ad and our
wow.
fact that it's here. And she's very, very enthusiastic about the project.
That's quite an endorsement because she is Irish.
She is Irish. And the other great endorsement is that the Maurice Welsh family, he died in 1945 or so. His grandchildren are coming to the opening from
wow.
Ireland.
Wow.
They're just so excited about it. So
great. So tell us what we can expect. I was privy enough to attend the stage reading that you did
right.
back a couple of years ago that just blew me away. The stories were tremendous.
Yeah, it's the intertwining of three different stories. I don't want to give you too many details, right. but there's a movie star, famous movie star. There's spies. There's, of course, the quiet man, the fighter from America that goes back to Ireland.
But he's younger than John Wayne, and he's a real...
Yeah.
In shape.
Yeah, he's not really John. He put John Wayne in. John
right.
Wayne is a 6'5" guy. Right. The character was a welterweight.
Okay.
In the book, so he's a smaller guy, but
scrappy Irishman.
And they're rehearsing this fight, which is going to be terrific. This morning, as part of the producer's job, I went and I gave him all the information about what emergency room to go to, and that I know the emergency room doctor, so in case anybody gets hurt. But they're terrific. Wait till you see this fight. They rehearse it. They've both been the two actors that are in the fight are been rehearsing, and they make it look fabulous, but they're not going to get hurt.
Well, so a lot of people remember the John Wayne and Victor McLaughlin. It's one of the funniest, one of the greatest scenes ever filmed, and just hysterical. They stop and have a drink in the middle of the fight, and then everybody's betting on them, and the bishop and the priest, everybody.
So that whole thing is going to be very exciting. We're looking forward to. I'm looking forward to the fight myself because I'm always worried about, you know.
Yeah, as a producer, you have to.
The motives of nobody get hurt here.
Yeah.
But they've been going to the gym, getting in shape. So Ron Reigns is one of the fighters.
Sure.
Who just came in.
Okay.
He was
one of the well-known Chicago actor based.
They've been going to the gym. They've been getting in shape, you know, so that they don't get hurt, which is, you know, they have to do it every night, which is not like when you do a movie, you know.
It could take you a month to film it, and it's kind of put together by the editor.
And, you know, in a movie, you fall down on a mattress. Over here, they've got to fall down on a hard stage. You know, they just put the stage in this morning or yesterday, and I fell down on my knees to see, you know, how uncomfortable it is. It's uncomfortable. It's planking.
Well, that's one of the things you appreciate about the live performances is, you know, there's no cut and take and do it over. They got to do it, and they got to land it every night.
And they may have to change things, you know, because of how the fight went today, or they hurt something, and they say, well, don't hit me on my left side, hit me, you know. So they've got to duck, and, you know, and all the other actors have to get involved. I went to school with Bill Polinsky years ago.
Oh, yeah, we'll get into that. The old candlelight.
I just want to tell you a little story. Sure. They made a musical of The Quiet Man. And
somebody told me that. Do you remember the name?
The name of the thing. It was called Donnybrook.
Donnybrook.
And I went to school with Phil Bosco, who's a New York actor.
Okay.
A lot of people won't know him, but he did a lot of movies, and he's always in a lot of shows in New York. And he played the bad guy, the bad fighter.
The McLaughlin kid, the big guy, yeah. The brother who Kate's just,
that's right.
Big guy.
And, you know, I went to New York to see it. It only lasted about a week, the show, because it was, you know. But it was a big fight on Broadway, too. And at the end of the fight, he falls into this water trough, you know. And he came to me after the show and said, oh, this is just awful. It's not going to fall in this tub of water. It's warm, but, you know, I still got to fall into it every night.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I didn't know they had made a musical of it.
They made a musical of it. It wasn't a big hit, you know. I was lucky to have seen it. You know,
not everything sings.
Yeah.
I think we found out.
Yeah.
But in The Quiet Man, from reading the press notes, is you're going to have some authentic Irish music in it with live musicians.
There's a couple of yes, there are. There are going to be. It's a pre-show kind of thing.
Okay.
Originally, they were going to be intertwined in the story, but it got to be. We thought it would slow down the story. So there is going to be a pre-show of real genuine Irish.
Oh, okay.
Musicians. I just, Frank Mann, my co-producer and author, was telling me their names.
Top local Irish. Well, we're blessed in Chicago. I'm big in folk music and the Irish music.
And we're going to have, now this is not going to happen all the time, but on opening nights and a couple of special occasions, we're going to have Bagpiper out in front of the Chicago Theater.
Well, that'll drum up to the interest. Yeah, you can hear a bagpipe miles away.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So we're going to see. We just got permission for that, you know, because we're not sure. Can you just have a bagpiper play?
Well, with Mayor Daley as the mayor, I think you're probably on good grounds there.
Yeah, so that's we feel good about that. Anyway, so I love Irish music. Years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I went to Europe and I saw a play called Stones in His Pockets.
Yes.
Do you know what it
was? Apple Tree Theater did it.
Did they?
Tremendous, yeah.
Which was based on
John Hoganocker and Will Klinger did it.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, it was a great show because it's about the
making a
movie in Ireland.
Right.
And some of the old timers that were there. When they made the original Quiet Man in Ireland.
That's right. They referred. I don't know if the version you saw, but here it was a two-person play
they had to play all the characters.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was very exciting. So there's a lot of. The Quiet Man has its own little subplot.
So is that what got you interested? Tell us
what got you
and your production, after all the successes you've had, and you guys know what's good and what's bad.
Yeah.
What got you interested as a producer to mount, you know, to get the show going?
Actually, Frank Mann, the author, came to Libby and I and said, I've got this play. Would you read it? And we read it and liked it. which you don't always like. And they said, well, can we'd like to do a reading. And we did actually two readings. Which one did you go to?
I was at the one at the Mercury Theater, probably okay. The second reading. I think you did one.
No, we did one after that.
Oh, you did one after that. Okay.
We did one at O'Brien's Restaurant.
Okay.
And that one had a music in it.
Okay.
And it really didn't work out as well as we liked. And so that's why we have the music happening before. Yeah, the one of the yeah.
So this is like somebody approached you on it. Right?
Yeah, so he approached us. We looked at it.
You writers out there that think that no one's ever going to read it. You guys do read the scripts, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Libby's my reader.
Okay, that's Libby Adler Majes.
Libby Adler Majes. We know Libby reads every play, and we have there's four or five we haven't gotten to yet because there's a lot of them. Yeah. They become complex, you know, and then you have. Then you have to raise money. You have to stage it. You have to, you know, you have to see if it's a viable product. It's always viable if it's a good show.
Okay. So how do you? Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to ask you. Everyone asks, where do you draw the line between, you know, commercialism, art, and entertainment? Where is that fine line?
This is a good show.
Okay. So you would consider art and entertainment?
Yes. Okay. The problem is it's a big cast show.
Okay.
So it's not going to be easy to make money with it.
Okay. Big cast show, and your ticket is under $50 for a fully professional show. That's terrific.
And there's discounts on that, too. You know, okay. If you're a group, you get a special price and whatever. But it's difficult, you know. And that's why we're in a theater under 300 seats. So we actually picked that out on purpose.
Okay.
To do that, so there's minimums that everybody gets paid because of that.
Right. Well, plus I think 300 seats add an intimacy and a togetherness with the audience.
I like that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait till you see it. It's gonna knock you down. You know, it's because of the intimacy of it. You know, you being so close to the project. When they have this fight, you're gonna think they're gonna hit you. You know, so And when you laughed, it's a very funny show. Oh, I have to tell you one thing. When I read it, I thought, oh, it's good. But I didn't think it was funny. Then when we staged it.
Oh, I was laughing all the way through it.
Yes, I didn't realize how funny it could be. And then we had two readings since then with this cast that's going to be at the Chicago Theater downstairs. It is very, very funny, you know.
But it's yet it's not totally a comedy, right?
No, it's not a comedy, but there's lots of humor in it. So,
well, the self-deprecating Irish humor is well known in all the great Irish writers,
right?
And that's what struck me about it is it was very funny. But then you get into high drama and you get into action. There's a lot going on.
There's a lot of action. I don't want to tell you some of the, you know, there's some tragedy in there too, you know, because of the spy that's there, and that's, you know, it's a husband and wife team, and you know, and
well, those were
there's a loyalty to Ireland.
Right. They called it the Troubles for a reason. That was a very tough time.
It's surprisingly timely, you know, with all this terrorists happening in the world today, you know,
Well, up until recently, even in Ireland.
I remember once I a few years ago, I canceled the trip to London because there was a bombing in London, you know. And
yeah, who wants to be sitting in the cafe?
Right,
yeah. So I think your timing is great on this show, too.
I think so, too.
It's opening March 6th.
That's
and you're
right.
Scheduled initially to run through May 24th.
Well, you know, if you say it's going to be here for a year, people let's go next September. So
you had to put a date on it.
We have to give you a framework in which
I think this is the kind of show that will get legs. You guys as producers are well known for producing quality shows. And so you got to be proud of this one. Huh?
Well, I am. It's hard to find good shows. This is, I think, a good show, good team.
Who's your director? Is
Susan Felder.
Okay.
She's she came in, she read the script. You know, everybody that's doing this always wanted to read the script first, you know, because it's a lot of time out of their life. She spent months working with the director, casting, doing a lot of work. So she didn't want to commit herself. until she looked at it.
This is a world premiere.
This is a world premiere. Yes, it's very exciting.
And the authors have been working with the cast.
They were at all the auditions, and you know, they've been working with it. Libby was at the audition. She really takes that whole artistic section. You know, she reads the script, says, "Oh, I cut this line out. That doesn't sound good." That kind of thing.
I didn't realize she gets that involved.
Oh, she's very detailed.
Because I know she's got tremendous taste when she worked with John Powers and so forth.
Oh yeah, yeah, They actually cut one of her favorite lines, you know. and she called me up from Florida. She's in Florida right now. She's coming back in a couple of weeks, and she says they cut that line. So she actually and they all agreed that they didn't want to cut it, but they cut it for whatever reason there was. I couldn't remember now, but then they put it back in. They said, "Yeah, we're going to put that line back in." You know, it was a funny, meaningful line, you know.
That's got to be exciting for you as a producer and the actors. The whole dynamic of creating a new play, which is different than, you know, remounting, you know, successful
That's
show.
Right.
Which I know in its own way has its challenges.
Well, it's more interesting than doing a play that's already been done, because you know you can just sit back and just do it. You know, if you're doing a show like Fiddler on the Roof, say you're not allowed to change the lines. You have to use
what you
got here. If somebody has to enter and says, "Oh, I can't say the line in enough time to do that," the author can say, "Hey, all right, we'll change it to this and do that." And so there's improvements, there's deletions. So let me ask you,
I've heard this, as a producer, are you one of the sort of referees when the artistic people have, you know, as this happens in shows, sometimes they have the little differences.
Well, that always happens.
I know that's part of it.
I'm the peacemaker.
Oh, okay.
I never take sides because, you know, because the show is going to be here for a long time. And every time I see this designer or whatever who says, you know, I wanted to do it in green and you made me do it in orange, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't take sides, but I try to pacify both of them. You know, let them look at it. Let's all look at it and see what it.
But of course, ultimately, though, you guys are the boss, right? I mean, if it comes down to that,
it doesn't. Okay. You know, we're the peacemakers, okay, and we also know what's good and bad. You know,
well, after 300 shows in 38 years,
right? I'm concerned more. Can the guy in the back row hear the lines?
Ah, you know, I'm with you on that.
You know, I remember a few years ago, there was this tap dancing show at the Schubert Theater where the guy danced with his back to the audience. And I says, "Oh, my God, that's terrible." I forget what his name is. But, you know, you're there to do a show that they can understand, that they're pleased with. And
it's amazing how many productions miss things like that. The blocking, somebody's blocked out, like I said, turning your back or turning your head away from the audience and dropping the last phrase, which has all the meaning in it.
Right. Yeah. Usually that's really all I care about. I always imagine myself the audience.
That's a great – somebody needs to do that in every production.
Absolutely. And the director is supposed to do that. But, you know, but they sometimes do it for dramatic license, you know. Mm-hmm. It looks better if you don't hear the lines. I remember seeing some Albee shows. We were talking about Albee. Yeah. And, you know, what did he say? You know, that was a great line. And the director had muttered or, you know.
That to me, that can kill a show.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I want to make sure because, you know.
So you're the consumer advocate as part of the
consumer, okay. Yes. I paid his money to see the show. Let's hear the line. Let's see his face. Let's, you know, if he's crying, I want to see those tears. Don't hide the tears. Show me the tears, that kind of thing.
Great. And, so that brings you bring all that experience.
That's what I do, and you know.
And I'm sure they sometimes look at you, right, and then they go, "Yeah, they never thought of it." You're right; they get caught up into the creative end.
And I always sit in the worst seats, and okay. I say, "Well, I want to be sure I hear it back here, and I want to be able to sure I see it back there."
Thank you for that lesson, because you know a lot of our listeners are people in the trade. And sometimes even in the small little storefront theaters, they just don't understand that.
Yeah, or they mumble, or they whisper lines, and you know, I says, "Hey, you know, these people paid for a ticket, you know, and you're wasting both time. The author wrote the line; he wants it heard, and you know, so."
Wow. Well, we can't wait. It's going to open on March 6th.
The March
at
6th.
The Downstairs Theater at the Chicago Theater, which
that's
is
right.
That's terrific. I mean, you're what a nice place to have a show.
It is. I didn't realize how nice it is, and it looked nice when I first saw it. We looked around.
Well, Sheer Madness had a nice run here.
They had a nice run, and actually, till 2 days ago, the Sheer Madness set was still there, and we just. We just took out the set, and we just put the platforming in so the actors could rehearse on it today.
Terrific.
So,
well, we're psyched about that. And Tony, let's talk about you as a producer and some of your background. I know you were managing director and partner with Bill Polinsky at Candlelight for 38 years.
That's correct.
Tell us how you guys got that started. And, okay. And I know I want to get into you did some innovations. For the first dinner playhouse in America. I mean, you guys are
Bill
our history.
Bill and I
guys.
Went to college together. Okay. We went to Catholic University in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
We were like Mickey Rooney and friends, and we decided one summer, this is as freshmen, and that we were going to do a show. We actually wanted to do it in a barn. In those days, they had what they called summer stock.
Summer stock.
That's what we wanted to do. And we couldn't find a place to do it. There was three blocks from the White House on G Street, a banquet hall, a vertical banquet hall, four floors, and up on the top floor there was a room, and they didn't do banquets much in the summertime. The guy says, maybe we can make a deal. We'll put the theater, you do the theater, we'll put the dinners in there, and that's how dinner theater was born.
Wow. You were the first guys in America to do it.
They never did it before. And I'm an electrical engineer.
Okay.
You know, so that's you asked about all these technical. Well, that's where it came from. And so Bill and I and our friends, we all ran this theater. We did the bookkeeping. We did ran the lights. I did the sets.
You were too young to know you couldn't do it.
Exactly.
So
right.
You did it.
Believe it or not, I remember Bill and I used to go to Samuel French. Geez, who's the big agent in New York? And we hired Equity Stars. There were TV stars at the time. Movies had or movie stars that had.
We're talking now in the '50s, right?
In the '50s.
Okay.
And we hired a couple 18-year-old kids going in, and
so you hire whoever the top, right?
You know, the big stars used to get $1,000 a week. That was a lot of money, you know.
Yeah.
A regular actor, union actor, got $65 a week in those days.
Wow.
We did dinner and theater for $3.95.
Wow,
so,
$3 a night.
And we had it was a 500-seat place, and it was an immediate success. I mean, it was like, why is this so successful? We just didn't understand it. We did it for 2 years.
They ate in the same room.
You sat at a table, and the show started. Dinner service stopped. All the waiters came off the floor, and the show went on. And we did that for 2 years in Washington, D.C. And then the third year, the guy says, I don't think I want to do it again. So that's how we moved to Chicago. Bill's family had a building in Summit, Illinois.
Okay.
And we moved it in there, and we were all still going to college, and we put a dinner theater there, and it became an immediate success.
That was the Candlelight Dinner Playhouse.
And we says, "Why is this so successful?" We didn't know. And I remember I was away at college, and Bill says, "We can't close for the winter. You know, people just want to keep on coming." So Bill was going to college in Boston. I was going to college University of Illinois, and we would commute back to do the shows. You know, we'd hire local people to do it.
That's fantastic.
And
didn't you do one of the innovations, one of the major innovations that has been copied all over the country?
Well,
tell us about that.
Well, I used to. I'm an electrical engineer, okay. So I approached everything, and I used to do all the scenery.
Okay,
but you know, in the round. It's hard to change sets, you know.
Sure
and
is.
You know, it's first supposed to be in this living room, then it's supposed to be in the dentist's office. So I says, I remember flying on an airplane once, and I remember the tray coming up out of the seat below, and I said, oh, that's a good idea. I think we'll just, and the people that put the elevator stage in the Opera House. I went to them and I says, "Could you put a 20-foot by 20-foot elevator stage in the middle?" "Yeah, sure, we can do that." Well, it was a little complicated because we didn't want the people, the customers, to fall in the hole when the stage went down.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you remember, there was a railing used to come up.
Yes, and went a down. Railing. I do remember
later,
the railing.
Later, we made the stage 30-foot by 30-foot, and we put like a 4-foot stage around the stage, so you couldn't fall in anymore. You had to actually go on stage.
Plus, it rotated.
And plus, it rotated, went up and down, and then later we kept innovating that. We had like sections of it go up and down and rotate. And then
but you set the standard for that all over the country, didn't you?
And then a whole bunch of theaters around the country, dinner theaters opened using that. Now, we had it patented, so they did little variations on that. Some of them came out of the ceiling on cable, but you had that cable holding them up.
So you actually did a patent. The government gave you a patent.
We got a government patent. Right. There was one in an evening dinner theater in New York, outside of New York, about 30 miles out of New York, did an elevator stage like ours, but they did it in proscenium.
Okay.
And they changed sets. There are still, believe it or not, a lot of these kind of elevator stages that actually bring the orchestra up. Out of the front.
I know Marriott Theater in Chicago uses a lot of the innovations.
Well, those are called scissor lifts. And later, when we started doing things, we did the big elevator, which would bring big scenery. It revolved. And built into that, we had scissor lifts, which are like 4x4 little sections that could go up 4 feet so that you could vary anything. I mean, we went on and on and on doing lots of variation. So it
and that added so much to the production. And to the creativities that they could do all these.
Right, exactly.
You never knew when you went to Candlelight what was going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. Those had to be great years. Eh?
Yeah, they were. And, you know, we were so successful at the Candlelight that Fiddler on the Roof ran over 2 years.
That's right. With Lee Pelty, yes.
Yes. And we were bored, Bill and I. This is, what are we going to do now? Because we wanted to do shows. He said, well, let's build it. We had a lot next door. Let's build another theater. And we built the Forum Theater to do proscenium shows, and that was a 450-seat theater. And we did shows there. We did, and then we actually, I remember we one of the first shows we did was Company.
Which, yes.
And we actually bought for $6,000 the Broadway set.
I didn't know that. That's true.
That was the Broadway set, and it fit it right in there.
How did that show do? Because that is, it's a very New York, but I think it's one of his best, one of Stoddard's specials.
I love it. And, you know, it went on tour, and it didn't make it, but it was a big success for us, got rave reviews, and did well.
Well, how about Phantom? Maury Jetson, when I interviewed him, he said that he owes to you and Bill for the money he's made on that, because you guys made that show successful.
Well, after we did it, we actually had, believe it or not, we had a convention at the theater of all the theater theaters in the country. Then there were, at the time, there were over 50 of them.
Okay.
They all came and saw Phantom, just happened to be playing at that time. They all started doing it.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said, you guys, it was first done in Houston. You guys made it such a big hit. And then he says everybody came in to see it. And
well, we changed it a little bit, and that whole elevator stage thing with the dungeon below, mm-hmm. and it worked very nice, and it was so, you know, it was more of the story of the Phantom of himself.
Well, it's so much stronger of a score, as I told Maury, than the Andrew Lloyd Webber's one.
Well, Cameron McIntosh came to the theater while Phantom.
Oh, he did?
He did.
Okay.
And I says, you know, this is, and he had read Maury Jetson's version. He says, yeah, but I already, you know, he already
committed.
He had committed himself, and he liked it, you know. But
well, there's room for both, but I personally think, first of all, you like the character,
right?
You care about him, and there's much more story.
Yeah. So,
but you guys did quite a few. You had the first regional rights to many shows, right? After they came off tour,
it was in those days. It was easy to get the rights to shows. They would play New York. Sometimes they went on tour, sometimes they didn't. When they went on tour and they played Chicago, usually they played Chicago from 2 to 4 weeks. Once they left Chicago, you could get the rights. Hello, Dolly, you know. We did it. We were the first people to do Hello, Dolly, the first people to do Fiddler on the Roof, the first people to do Man of La Mancha. You know, it's I think the only show we didn't do first was Cabaret, because there was another dinner theater in Chicago called In the Round that did it first.
Okay.
And a lot of times we were doing a show when other shows became available. You know, we never had a set run. You know, we did all shows for 3 months and, four months. And if it was a hit, we would extend it. And, you know, that's how Fiddler ran for 2 years.
But then later you got into, subscriptions, right?
When we got into the script, we were set for the dates.
But a lot of people realizing now, and all the problems in New York with shows closing, one of the things that Chicago did so smartly was developing a subscription base.
That's right.
So that, you know, you get your money for the year ahead, and you're almost guaranteed an audience.
Right. Well, it's guaranteeing the audience that's important.
And you were one of the first guys to do that, I believe.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it worked very well. And we tried variations on it, like... buy a subscription, you're not set on the date. People, you know, do you want to make a plan on what you're going to do a year from now on a Tuesday?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, who knows?
And people don't want to do that. So we've formulated this plan where you bought a subscription, you got a ticket to a show, and you could call at a certain date later and actually make that appointment, you know. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah.
Bookkeeping nightmare before the internet.
It is a bookkeeping nightmare.
Now you can do it easily.
When we started, there was no credit cards. You couldn't make a credit card reservation. You had to actually go to the box office of whatever theater you were going to and buy the ticket. We started phone reservations. So you could call us. We would actually reserve the seats
for you. I used to do that.
Right. Yeah. You couldn't call the Schubert to do that.
I had to go downtown to get tickets.
You had to go downtown and buy a ticket. So we would hold the tickets for you, and you had to pay for it a couple of ways. And then when credit cards came out, really, that's when they, you know, in the 60s. Whatever.
So you guys have really been innovative.
So,
well, in the interest of time, we're running out of time here. That we could go on for hours. And I am planning, folks, coming up, but before the end of 2009, we are going to do an hour-long candlelight show, kind of a reunion with all the key people in town, you and Bill and everyone else, your wife, Eileen, and everyone who started Candlelight, including a lot of the actors. I've never had more interest from the community. They all say, oh, I want to be there. So we're going to put that together. But ask us, tell me now, some of the shows you're proudest of. It's like asking which child you like the best.
I loved Into the Woods. That's one of my favorites. I'm a great Sondheim freak.
I am too, yes.
So Into the Woods, Company. I'm trying to think.
I'm glad you mentioned Company because... I've been trying to. Somebody needs to do that. It hasn't been done here in a while.
Nobody does it. Why?
It's a great show.
It's a great show. Yeah. It's got young people. It's timely. It's like a Sex and the City.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a universal show. Yeah, it could play any era.
I like those. Of course, I love Fiddler on the Roof and Man of La Mancha. I remember I saw Man of La Mancha was not a big hit when
Richard Kiley.
I saw it in Richard Kiley in New York. I saw it at this little place, and I thought, oh, wow, this is a fabulous show. I remember reading Don Quixote as a kid.
Right.
You know.
Well, I like what you guys did with it. I thought it was better than the tour.
It actually fit the room perfectly. And, right. You know, it just...
And recently, your Newt Rockne show. I got to congratulate. I hope that show gets to New York.
Is it good?
Because I'll tell you what... You guys need to put another place on your trophy shelf because that show is awesome.
Everybody loves it, and we're still working on it. We're actually they're doing a presentation in California in a week.
Great.
We've made a CD of the music, which we're not selling it, just for insiders.
Let me know because I love the score. I'd sure like to hear that.
Okay, there's a Newt Rockne dinner that we're all gonna that we're going to, and we're going to do some of the leads are going to sing at that. And
right, because I think that show could be a mega hit, don't you?
I think so, because I'm not a sports guy. So, funny story about that is the author, came and many years ago was in Chicago trying to sell the show.
Is Buddy Farmer talking?
Buddy Farmer. Yeah. And he comes to Libby and I, and, I'm a producer. So my first question is, how many football players are there on a team? Because you gotta have the
Yeah.
You know.
When he said 11, did you faint?
Well, yeah. I said that's a lot of people
on each side, right?
On each side, you know, that's 22 people that we're gonna have on stage. That's a lot, you know. So you gotta ask those kind of questions, you know.
And sports plays have a problem.
They always have had a problem.
Yeah, but this one, well, this really, one is more than that. It's about more, Notre Dame. It's about America,
and it's about his family and yeah. his children yeah. and his wife and you know, his attitude and.
Great. Well, folks, stay tuned. Tony, I'm so privileged to have you on, well, and we know that the Quiet Man will be good. We know the material, and with you guys bringing your expertise to the party, I'm sure it will be a terrific show.
I love it from what I've seen in rehearsal. Anyway, right after this podcast, I'm going to take in just a peek in at.
Okay. Oh, that would be cool. Well, folks, thanks for listening. And remember, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I am your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of February 23rd, 2009. Chicago Shakespeare Theater will conclude its season with Twelfth Night, William Shakespeare's comedy of disorder and revelry. The show will be staged by London's Bush Theater artistic director Josie Rourke. Twelfth Night is often regarded as Shakespeare's most perfect comedy. It is set in the make-believe country of Illyria, where nothing that is so is so. The Chicago Shakespeare Theater's courtyard stage will be flooded with water to create the coast of the imaginary world. Twelfth Night runs from March 29th through June 7th in the Courtyard Theater. Tickets are currently available and may be purchased by following the links on theaterinchicago.com. Court Theater continues their 2008-2009 season with the classic psychological thriller Wait Until Dark. The production will run at the Court Theater from March 5th through April 5th. It's about a cool-as-ice psychopath who smooth-talks his way into the home of an unsuspecting blind woman. Spend an evening on the edge of your seat with the genre that Hitchcock helped make a classic. Wait Until Dark is written by Frederick Knott. He was an English playwright and screenwriter who is best known for his thrillers Dial M for Murder and Write Me a Murder. Tickets for Court Theater's Wait Until Dark are currently available, and you know where to find them. Victory Gardens Theater has announced their new executive director. Jan Kalish comes to the Victory Gardens from the Nederlander organization and also the former executive director of the Auditorium Theater. Jan Kalish is replacing Marcel McVeigh, who is the wife of Victory Gardens' current artistic director, Dennis Zajcik. Congratulations, Jan Kalish. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Tony D'Angelo for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.